Welcome to the Limbic Podcast. I'm Jackie Zill. Crysvita, or burosumab, has transformed the treatment landscape of the rare genetic disease X-linked hyperphosphatemia, or XLH, in both children and adults. In this podcast, Associate Professor Peter Sim, a pediatric endocrinologist from Melbourne, speaks to Dr. Penny Coates, an endocrinologist and pathologist from Adelaide, about the management of adult patients with XLH, including assessments, treatment options and goals, and the importance of transitional care from childhood to adulthood. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Thank you very much, Penny, for joining me for this discussion this afternoon. We'll start off by talking about how XLH manifests in adults compared with children. So what do you find are the symptoms you're most likely to see in your adult patients with either undiagnosed or unmanaged XLH?
Oh, thanks, Pete. So adults are a little bit different. In children, we're obviously worried about growth and development. In adults, present with pain is probably the biggest symptom that they'll have. And whether that's pain due to arthritis or enthesopathy, tendon problems, which affects almost all adults, and the older you get, the worse it gets. Whether it's related to pain from their teeth with their dental decay and abscesses and so on, or whether it's related to other symptoms that relate to long-term not managed conditions. And so here we're starting to talk about fatigue, functional problems like muscle weakness and reduced mobility, and that then pushes over into issues with employment and other parts of their lives. And then there's the other classical symptoms that you'd see in children as well. So the short stature, if someone hasn't been managed their whole lives, and bone deformity. But pain and fatigue, really the common problems. And this can be very difficult for someone who's seeing a lot of adults, because joint pain and fatigue are very, very common symptoms indeed. And someone who may have been managed as a child may not necessarily present so obviously with short stature as a child might.
So I suppose within that, those sort of classic symptoms of pain and fatigue, which, as you're saying, are very common, what are the red flags that might pop up that will guide you in the direction of the XLH diagnosis?
Yes. So fractures is a big flag. An adult who's not only complaining of pain and fatigue, but's having recurrent fractures needs further investigation. Obviously, if they are short in stature, or if they have bone deformity, those are red flags. And the presence of multiple dental abscesses is also something we don't usually see, particularly in young adults these days in Australia. So those are the kind of things that might make you think, actually, this is not simple arthritis or aging. This is perhaps something more.
Right. And so if you're thinking this could be something more and you're suspecting XLH, what sort of assessments do you recommend, and when would you start referring more broadly to other craft groups?
Right. Well, obviously, by definition, these patients have a low phosphate. So that's the first test to do, is a general chemistry. And to make the diagnosis, the phosphate does need to be below the lower reference limit. Now, there are other things that can play in here. So you need to consider other reasons why phosphate might be low. And it can be low temporarily in a lot of other situations, including acute illness, including situations where the patient's not eating for a while. So this needs to be something that you see as a sustained thing, and that you've also excluded things like vitamin D deficiency as an issue. And sometimes you'll need to do it again if you weren't quite sure if it was borderline. You can sometimes see a slight increase in phosphate if there was something wrong with the sample, say it was hemolyzed. So sometimes you just do need to rethink it. But, I mean, having convinced yourself that you've got a true hypophosphatemia, you then need to be able to demonstrate renal phosphate wasting. And that is easiest done by calculating the tubular maximum phosphate, which you probably talked about in the children's discussion. It's a theoretical idea that what we say is that there's a threshold in the kidney for phosphate excretion. And once you've gone above that threshold, then there's going to be a linear increase in phosphate excretion above that point. And so you can calculate this using a spot urine phosphate along with the blood. And there are free calculator available in Australia on ASBMR website. Now, just because you've got a low phosphate and renal phosphate wasting doesn't mean this is XLH either. There are a whole lot of other common clinical conditions which can produce this problem, particularly primary hyperparathyroidism is classically known to produce a low TMP GFR and lowish phosphate quite often. And there are other acquired conditions, including iron infusion, not seen so much in children, but certainly seen in adults, which is actually FGF23 mediated hypophosphatemia, and other rarer syndromes like Fanconi syndrome. So you then also need to rule these out. And so a blood calcium is essential, vitamin D metabolites, and you would expect FGF23, which is available, to be elevated or at least inappropriately normal. FGF23 is a bit of a fussy thing to measure. You do need to handle it carefully, but it is not that difficult to spin it quickly after collection and keep it cold for transport. And it's only at that point that we might start thinking about getting a more detailed family history, which is usually helpful, and then thinking about genetic investigations into the PHEX gene, PHEX gene, and then thinking about other imaging. It's not usually necessary to do, for example, a bone density despite the fractures. It's not usually necessary to do things like bone scans with nuclear medicine, but we might well think about plain x-rays or other modalities if there's localized pain. And then the other things that we might do depend very much on symptoms. So whether you're going to do hearing tests, whether you're going to do MRIs of the head looking for Chiari malformations, really, I think, depend on how the patient's presenting. That's not usually a routine thing. But you know, just to recap, really, the essential things to demonstrate hypophosphatemia, renal phosphate wasting, and at least exclude common other conditions before you can say, look, this is probably what I'm dealing with.
Thank you, Penny. Yeah, it certainly requires a very comprehensive and stepwise assessment to make sure that you're heading down the right path, both in pediatrics and adults. You mentioned the importance of family history in a condition where the majority of patients, it will be hereditable. So how do you go about this in terms of screening family members, particularly trying to uncover perhaps previously undiagnosed or untreated XLH?
Well, I mean, it's the first step is obviously to take a very careful family history. Many families, but particularly by the time you've got an adult who may not be aware of what their parents and grandparents were like, let alone cousins, nieces and nephews, this may take a while. And you might want to have the support of genetic counselling service to achieve this. They've certainly got better access to genetic linkage services. But I think the family history is essential, and remembering that it's an X-linked dominant condition will help direct which family members you think are likely to be affected. So, for example, an unaffected man will not need to have his sons screened for, you know, those kinds of simple, obvious ways of limiting the screening that you do. But it is important to do this because even within the same family with the same mutation, the way that people present can vary quite a bit. So you can get people who are very badly affected and people whose symptoms are very mild. However, their children, if they also are affected, may be quite different. And so it's important for the next future generations, as well as the patient in front of you, to try and work out who may need further treatment. So that's why it is important. Most patients have a mutation that's determinable. Although you do see de novo mutations, most patients actually, you will find a family history if you go looking.
Yeah, thank you. It's certainly something that we deal with a lot in pediatrics, where we have the, you know, relatively severely affected child in front of us, and often the adult who's battled away with the condition for many years and often has left medical care, and trying to encourage them to get back into medical care, or possibly they were never diagnosed and to go and seek diagnosis. So I think it's great for both pediatric and adult endocrinologists to think about the relatives of their patient who's sitting in front of them. So we might just move on now to talk about treatment. So certainly for decades, we were bashing away with conventional therapy with phosphate and vitamin D supplements. which was suboptimal in many ways and also very difficult to tolerate, particularly for us in pediatrics, where we were trying to give children 7 or 8 doses of phosphate a day, which is not really compatible with everyday childhood life. So in recent years, the arrival of monoclonal antibody therapy in the guise of burosumab, we've seen studies showing in children and adults that this therapy has better outcomes than conventional therapy. So in this sort of new burosumab era, Penny, what do you think the optimal care of XLH looks like?
Well, look, I think I'm going to leave the pediatric side of it to you. So I'm going to assume that a child is going to come to me having reached their, hopefully as close to their predicted adult height as they could to be independent, to not have this lifetime history of pain and, perhaps dental complications, although that's harder to determine. So in good care of an adult, we're looking for not so much normalizing the phosphate as the goal, because many of these patients, as you say, have gone for a number of years with lowish phosphate without necessarily too much else. We're looking at control of pain, healing of fractures, maintaining a good psychosocial function, and that has been shown in adults as well as children that as you treat people effectively, that you improve their function in terms of mobility, ability to get up out of a chair, walk around, do their normal day-to-day activities, as well as heal fractures. We have not yet been able to show resolution of some of the issues. And I think that may be because the clinical trials and the direct clinical experience has been relatively short. And so a lot of the issues, particularly with dental health, where there is a slower metabolism in teeth compared to bones, I think are going to take a lot longer for us to definitely say one way or the other whether we can correct that. But there's also an idea that we will help to prevent some of the other complications of treatment, conventional treatment, particularly nephrocalcinosis, and hopefully helping to prevent tertiary hyperparathyroidism and some of the other more difficult to control complications. But so far, really, the experience in clinical trials and in the clinic has been mostly to do with pain and day-to-day function.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, certainly some of the adult fracture data on healing fractures is really quite extraordinary as well.
Definitely.
And how that links in with pain, I'm sure is marked. And as you say, function, which at the end of the day, this is all about having our patients as functional as possible and living their best lives. So I'm just conscious that, I mean, it's a fascinating conversation, but just in terms of trying to just look at a couple of final things. Obviously, one factor that we share across pediatrics and adults is transition of care, and it's an issue that continues to plague us in terms of how to do it properly. And as I alluded to before, and you mentioned having adults who are lost to care for many years is an issue. So what do you think some of the factors are for patients being lost in adulthood, and how are we going to try and get them to re-enter for therapeutic care, particularly now that there are newer therapeutic options available?
Look, we all have looked after patients who really didn't tolerate conventional treatment very well and were more than glad to stop it as soon as they'd finished growing and said, look, what am I doing this for? And there were a number of patients as adults who, I think perceived futility that they thought, look, nobody's doing anything. They're just watching me and dragging me back and for what am I getting? So the first thing I think is to be able to offer something which is effective. And I'm hoping that patients who connect with patient groups are going to get that message. We also, I guess those patients who we've seen before ourselves, we can reconnect with, and I've certainly done that with patients and said, look, we've got other options now. Would you like to communicate? But it is more difficult. The patients are more spread out. In pediatric practice, they tend to be concentrated in specialist centres in a few public hospitals. Adult care is more distributed, and we're lucky in Adelaide that we have a small number of metabolic bone clinics, but that's not the case elsewhere in the country. And I think it's a case of us perhaps collaborating with each other as endocrinologists and with our paediatric colleagues to try and get communication more directly to people who might benefit from it. I'm not saying it's going to be an easy matter, though. And I think transition from paediatric to adult care is difficult with any chronic condition, and this is one of them. So I think the best thing we can hope for there is that people have actually recognised the benefit of the treatment for them and are keen to continue with it. So that's one thing I'm hoping to get out of newer treatments.
Yeah, thank you, Penny. I mean, certainly, as you say, transition continues to bedevil us across the disease spectrum, not just here. So do you think that, just finally, patients who were treated with conventional therapy in childhood and have been on supportive care into adulthood should be approached to try and consider burosumab therapy? And how would you go about this?
So, as I said, a lot of us maintain our own databases of patients who we've seen in metabolic clinic, and that's obviously an easy way. I think the things that we need to consider a careful review of quality of life issues, and those are the kind of things that we will monitor on treatment. This is actually one of the difficulties with adults in getting renewal for burosumab therapy, is how do you show an improvement? And so doing baseline and follow-up assessment of quality of life, preferably using questionnaires which have been already validated for this purpose, I think is essential. And that's one way that we can explore with patients what kind of effects they actually have. And it's surprising that even with patients I've had who've been relatively mildly affected, what I thought for symptoms, are absolutely convinced that they want to continue with treatment, that it's worth the inconvenience of showing up every 4 weeks for their two injections. And again, it's mostly to do with pain and with energy levels, even in mild patients. So I personally think it should be offered. I've had a couple of patients who weren't interested, who've said, no, I've been on conventional therapy my whole life, I don't see why I should change. But I think it should at least be discussed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think also the key role worth acknowledging that XLH Australia have played in this process. You know, it's a support group that didn't even exist a few years ago, and the work that they've done in promoting new therapies and in trying to encourage people that they come in contact with to attend and to attend for medical care has been really quite extraordinary. I don't know if you've experienced any of those directly, but certainly through our families, we've seen lots of networking that's been facilitated by XLH Australia, which has been incredible.
No, I've definitely had a young adolescent who turned up on her first visit saying, can I get it? And it wasn't available at that stage, but then I was able to get hold of her a year later and say, guess what, we can now get started.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's just incredible how, you know, how effectively with modern technology and communication systems that news can spread. And so, yeah, I think it's been great seeing how that's really been beneficial to this patient group. Well, look, Penny, it's been a fascinating discussion. I really thank you for your time and comments today. And yeah, we look forward to hopefully being able to discuss more issues in the future and continue to work together as paediatric and adult colleagues.
Yeah. Lovely to talk to you too, Pete. Thank you.
Thank you.
Views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenter alone and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the sponsor. This information is not medical advice, and no decision relating to the management of any patient should be made with reliance on the information contained in this podcast. It is your responsibility to prescribe appropriate treatments in accordance with your clinical judgment and by reference to the appropriate Australian product information or other information supplied with the relevant product, including in relation to any indication, dosage, and route of administration.